On my 13th birthday, my father took me to lunch at the Poodle Dog, one of San Francisco's oldest restaurants, the kind of place with red leather banquettes and smoke-stained walls. It had been part of the city's fabric for so long that no one cared any longer that it had once been a notorious, quote, French restaurant, with rooms upstairs rented by the hour. I loved the Poodle Dog for its name and its creamy vichyssoise sprinkled with delicately cut chives. My birthday present was a checking account, which might seem an unusual gift for a young girl, but my parents had decided that learning to manage my money was a quick route to maturity. And I looked forward to having control over my small savings. When my father and I finished eating, we walked down Montgomery Street to the main office of Wells Fargo Bank, where crystal chandeliers hung from a high ceiling and tellers waited on customers from behind marbled counters. We headed straight to a gentleman at a desk in the back. Dad said a few words, and the elderly banker pulled out a thick white card embossed with a gold stagecoach. He signed my name to it and then looked at me with a grave expression. "Don't lose this," he said, explaining it was identification for my checking account. "It's not replaceable." The first time I pulled the card out of my wallet at a branch of Wells Fargo Bank, I was amazed at the reaction I got. Even though I was too young to drive and could barely see over the counter, the bank teller treated me with exaggerated courtesy. She didn't even ask to see a picture ID. She didn't have to check with the manager when I wrote a check. She just gave me my money. The carte blanche was the first clue I had that my family held special status at Wells Fargo Bank. Yet I had only the vaguest notion of why the card got me VIP treatment. I was aware that my great-great-grandfather, Isaias Hellman, had something to do with Wells Fargo Bank, but the exact relationship eluded me. My family had been in California for 5 generations, and we were well-to-do, but my relatives rarely discussed our past. It was not until 27 years later that I fully understood why a descendant of Isaias Hellman commanded so much respect at the bank.
Good evening and welcome to A Novel Idea. This is Rosemary Manchester, your host. You've been listening to a reading from the prologue of a biography, Towers of Gold, How One Jewish Immigrant Named Isaias Hellman Created California. The author, Frances Dinkelspiel, is here in the studio with me. Welcome, Frances.
Thank you for having me.
You're a fifth-generation Californian. That's quite unusual. A graduate of Stanford, where the auditorium is named for your grandmother, Florence Dinkelspiel, and you're a former reporter from San Jose Mercury News and freelance writer. That's quite a resume.
Well, I've been here a long time, and so I've tried my hand at a number of things.
Mm-hmm. And you've written a splendid book about your great-great-grandfather, Isaias Hellman. You left a career as a journalist to write this book.
Well, yes, I did. I took a leave of absence from my job at the San Jose Mercury News to write personal essays. And I thought at the time it would probably be just a temporary stop. But I decided one day to go down to the California Historical Society in San Francisco and take a look at some family papers because I thought they would enhance my personal essays. And when I walked into the Historical Society and asked to see the documents concerning Isaias Hellman, the archivist said to me, "Well, of course you can see the documents of Mr. Hellman, but which box would you like to see?" And I said, "What do you mean, which box?" And she said, "Well, there are 40 boxes of Hellman documents. We have more than 50,000 pages of his letters and business correspondence." So that was a bit of a surprise for me. Mm-hmm. And I started to look through them, and at first I didn't really know what I was looking at. I saw a report card from a school in Germany. I saw something that was a land contract in L.A. And then I started to notice that all these iconic names, names that I'd grown up with, were on these pages. Names like Collis Huntington, the man who built the Transcontinental Railway, Meyer Lehman, the man who started Lehman Brothers, Levi Strauss, the jeans manufacturer. And I realized that Isaias Hellman had done business with all these men and that he had a very interesting story that I wanted to tell.
Mm-hmm. You say in the book, "I stumbled on every reporter's dream, an unknown story about a critical chapter in the country's history."
That's right. Even though Isaias Hellman is my great-great-grandfather, and I didn't really know very much about him, I grew up knowing that my family had something to do with Wells Fargo Bank, but I never really knew what that meant. And it was not until I was 13 and my father decided to give me a checking account for my birthday that I first realized my family had this interesting association with Wells Fargo Bank. My father took me down to the bank and introduced me to an elderly banker who gave me a white credit card size identification card. And he told me to use it when I went to use my checking account. And I still vividly remember the reaction I received the first time I pulled out this card at my local branch of Wells Fargo Bank, because the teller treated me with extraordinary courtesy. She gave me my money right away. She didn't ask her manager why this small 13-year-old girl was trying to cash a check. And that made me realize that my family and Isaias Hellman did have this interesting relationship with Wells Fargo Bank. So I sort of remember that, and the more I looked through these documents at the California Historical Society, and the more I saw what Hellman had done, I realized that he was a man who played a pivotal role in the creation of California. He not only was a very well-known and influential banker, but he helped create many, many industries throughout the state.
I'm going to highlight just a few of those as before we get into the narrative itself, just to give our listeners an idea of the many, many things that Isaias Hellman did. He developed the trolley lines in Los Angeles and San Francisco, funded the discovery of oil in Southern California, led the building of the first synagogue in Los Angeles, helped start University of Southern California, was a regent of the University of California system, controlled the California wine industry for 20 years, calmed the financial markets in San Francisco after the 1906 earthquake, and founded the Wells Fargo Bank. Your great-great-grandfather was famous in his lifetime, one of the richest men in California. How could such an important man fall into obscurity?
That's a very good question, and I try to answer that in my book. I'm not sure that I found the right answer, but I do believe it had something to do with Hellman's Jewish heritage. He had grown up in a small town in Germany called Reckendorf, and Germany in those days did not give citizenship to Jews. And in fact, the country tightly controlled where Jews worked, where they lived, who they married. They had to pay a tax to enter a town or to be buried. So all these restrictions prompted a mass emigration to the United States in the 1850s. Hellman went on to tremendous success, as you just sort of recounted some of his accomplishments. And he was not shy about talking to the press about the economy or his banks. And he also, you know, loved to build lavish mansions, so he lived very well. But in many ways, he didn't brag about himself. I don't think he was very comfortable putting his name on buildings or doing anything that would make him stand out too much. For much of his life, he paired himself usually with a non-Jewish partner. And I think that all sort of reflects that his idea of how to go through life, which is it's fine to do well in business, but don't stick your neck out too far, because as a Jew, you're putting yourself up for criticism. Mm-hmm. So I think that's part of the reason he's not well known today.
Mm-hmm. And again, you say in the book, Isaias almost single-handedly brought California into modernity.
One of the things I found out is, you know, when people think about the Wild West, they usually think about the violence of the Wild West, the lone sheriff walking down the street or a gun battle between outlaws. But there was another kind of Wild West, and that was the wild financial system. Banks in California were illegal until the 1870s. The state was sort of run on gold. There was no paper money used. People exchanged Spanish coin or gold nuggets. And anyone could set themselves up as a banker. And there were no capital requirements. So you could open a bank one day and it could close the next and people would lose all their money. And there were many bank panics in the 19th century in California. So what I discovered in my research was that Isaias Hellman really was a man who tamed the financial system of the Wild West. And he brought regulation and he calmed everything down. And so I think that actually was a very critical aspect of the development of California.
And much of that is just a tribute to his character, that he was calm. He had tremendous integrity. People trusted him. And that's, after all, that's the foundation of banking, is trust.
Well, that's exactly true. Isaias Hellman was always a conservative banker, which meant that he always kept large gold reserves on hand. And as I explained in my prologue, which began the opening of this program, you know, the thing he feared the most was that a bank would close or that a customer would come in and not be able to get the money he or she wanted. So he always kept a large amount of money on hand to make sure that didn't happen. And he would say, I'm not a speculator, I'm a banker. And of course, you know, that mode of business is not in vogue anymore, as we are seeing in our current economic crisis.
I kept imagining him commenting on our current banking system and its shortcomings. And we have strayed so far from the ideals that he set up for banking. And I could just imagine him hardly being able to believe that it had gotten to the situation that it's in today.
I think you're right. I think if, you know, anyone can turn over in their grave, Isaias Hellman is turning over in his grave.
I believe so. You begin the story in 1893 in a scene at the California Pavilion at the Chicago World's Fair. Governor Henry Markham is boasting about the state. The California population is growing rapidly, he says, and the financial institutions are in, quote, splendid condition, unquote. Meanwhile, back in Los Angeles, the city is heading for a financial crisis. The Farmers and Merchant Bank is besieged by customers who want their money, and other banks are in a similar crisis. And when Isaias Hellman comes to the rescue, the word gets around town, and they say, Hellman is here. Hellman is here. And that seems to quell the panic.
Yeah, isn't it remarkable that one man can come into a town with a lot of money and calm everything down, that he had sufficient stature, both sort of professionally and personally, that people would look at him and feel like, okay, here's a man that's going to make everything all right. Mm-hmm. I think that's not very common in our world today, and it's something I think we all long for. Perhaps it belongs to a different era. But Hellman did have that effect. He was able to sort of convey a sense of stability. And he had such keen intelligence that people trusted him. And he was also honest. He wasn't out to make a buck off everybody. So people responded to that.
Mm-hmm. The book reads like a novel. I mean, the story is marvelous as you develop the story. And I loved your technique of interspersing vivid scenes with the narrative so that we could move from the very smooth narrative of what was going on to a scene like the one at the Chicago World's Fair. And then throughout the book, they're interspersed. And the reader learns to just look forward to them as they are kind of signposts on the narrative path.
Well, I'm glad to hear you say that because I work very hard on those scenes. I'm a big reader myself, and I do like to be drawn into a story. And the problem with sort of writing a book that's based on, you know, on documents, I can't go interview people to say, what was it like then? What was the weather like then? What were people eating and wearing? So I had to go back to newspapers and research, you know, the temperature and what was going on at a certain part of the day. And I had to look at pictures and sort of use all these inert objects and bring them into the writing in order to try to make something come alive. And for a newspaper reporter, I had never done this. So it took a lot of practice, but eventually I think I got better at it.
And you have extensive notes in the back citing your primary sources so that if a reader wants to follow up on something, he or she can be directed to a place where they can do further research on their own.
Fortunately, Isaias Hellman was a pack rat. So he saved everything from the receipts when his wife went to visit the dressmaker, receipts from the newspapers he bought, to important correspondence with men like Edward Harriman or Meyer Lehman, detailing business deals and personal things. So I was able to look through all these documents and find out new information. You know, this book is based mostly on primary sources.
How long did it take you to write the book?
This was a long time. It took me 8 years to write the book.
Oh, my goodness.
As I said, I had to go through all these documents. And, you know, in the beginning, he wrote in this very old Germanic script that is really beautiful to look at, but very hard to read. So it would take a long time to figure out what each letter said. And then I traveled around both the country and the world trying to gather more information. Yes. I went to his birthplace in Germany to see where he came from.
Yes. Tell me about that, the town of Reckensburg, is that it in Bavaria?
It's the town of Reckendorf.
Reckendorf, sorry. Mm-hmm.
Well, Reckendorf, where Isaias Hellman comes from, and I tell this in Towers of Gold, is a small town in sort of southeastern Germany, and it's set by a river, and it was a predominantly Catholic town. Two-thirds of the population was Catholic, and one-third was Jewish. And its main product was beer, believe it or not. And the Jews who lived in the town were mostly cattle traders. They would raise cattle and sell it on market, or weavers. You know, it was a very small town. It wasn't really connected to any larger cities. There were a few larger places nearby. But so it was a very isolated and sort of insular world that Isaias Hellman grew up in. But interestingly enough, from this small town in Germany came many of the men and women who made California what it is. Isaias Hellman came to California with members of a family called the Haas family, who today are the owners of Levi Strauss & Company, who are very large philanthropists. There's the Haas School of Business at Berkeley. There was another family called the Walters, who ran a rug and furniture store in San Francisco, who were very successful and philanthropic. So from this small town where, you know, Jews struggled, they got some education but not a lot of education, they came to the United States, and by my calculation, about 8 to 10 of them became multimillionaires right away, or like within 20 years.
That's amazing, isn't it?
Yeah, there must have been something in the water, I think.
So Isaias and his brother Herman set out at the ages of 16 for Isaias and 15 for Herman, traveled 6 weeks by steamship to New York, steamship to Panama, across Panama, a ship to San Francisco, and another ship to Los Angeles. 6 weeks, can you imagine? Now, why Los Angeles?
Well, it's an interesting question because the big city in California in 1859 was San Francisco, which had grown tremendously after the discovery of gold in 1848. And Los Angeles in 1859 was more Mexican pueblo than American city. Spanish was the first language that was spoken. French was the second most popular. And English was only the third most popular. And it took 2 days by steamer to get to L.A. There was no telegraph connection. And violence was very common. People say there was a murder a day there. But for some reason, some of Hellman's relatives had made their way to Los Angeles. And so when he and his brother Herman came, they made their way down to Los Angeles where they could work as a clerk in one of their cousin's dry goods store. Mm-hmm. So I don't know why the original Hellman went to Los Angeles, but by, I'd say, the early 1860s, there were about 12 Hellmans in the city and probably one of the largest Jewish families in the area.
Mm-hmm. In your book, you have a fine description of the town of 4,000 people when in those days with packs of wild dogs running around. And I enjoyed the historic pictures that you had in the book, some very interesting photographs and maps, drawings of the early Los Angeles settlement. A very important part of the book, I thought. And then, of course, many family photographs.
This was part of the fun of this doing this book is, you know, I grew up in San Francisco. I always had this image of Los Angeles as this metropolis, as millions and millions of people. And to discover that it was really this insignificant outpost, there's no reason Los Angeles should have developed. It's not by a navigable river. It's 20 miles from a port. It doesn't really have anything going for it. But what it did have was a group of men like Isaias Hellman and others who almost willed Los Angeles into existence. You know, as they set up dry goods stores And then as they set up banks, they sort of took over the reins of creating the city. They built gas lines. They built water mains. You know, they brought the railroad to Los Angeles. They fought to make Los Angeles bloom. Mm-hmm. And that was very interesting to find out.
They believed in the future of Los Angeles and were willing to work for it.
Absolutely.
Yeah, very interesting. The first thing that happened was a flood shortly after Isaias got there. Did he have a store by that time, or was he still working at his uncle's store?
He was still working with his cousin's store.
Cousin, right.
And poor L.A. went through this series of natural disasters. In 1861, it rained so hard that the Los Angeles River overflowed, and it went crashing through the center of the town, and it drenched all the goods in the Hellman's dry goods store. Mm-hmm. And the year of rain was followed by 2 years of merciless drought. And then it was followed by, you know, grasshoppers eating all the grass that was left. And then smallpox came in. So L.A. over like a 5-year period just was completely transformed by nature.
You have to marvel that they stuck it out, that they stayed through all that diversity. They were really committed, weren't they?
Yes, you're right. They could have very easily gone somewhere else, mm-hmm. but they stayed.
Mm-hmm. When Isaias opened his own store, he was still very young. Part of his secret, you say, is that he worked as his own middleman. He went up to San Francisco to get the goods himself and bring them back. And also that the business was done on credit. That was very important in those days.
Well, right. As I said earlier, banks were illegal in California, and most people just kept money hidden away somewhere in their houses. And oftentimes they didn't have enough money to pay for goods. So if they wanted to buy anything, they would have to buy it on credit. Mm-hmm. And Hellman extended credit after he opened his own dry goods store. And that sort of made things flow. It's just like the same situation today. If there isn't credit to go around, mm-hmm. the whole economic system gets sort of gummed up. Mm-hmm. Hellman used to take the steamer up to San Francisco, where he would go into some of the larger wholesale houses. And some of those houses were owned by the men he grew up with in Reckendorf, the Haas family and the Walter family. And this was also an interesting thing I discovered, that these people who were boyhood friends came to the United States together. They helped one another when they were dry goods merchants. And then as they got more and more powerful, they invested in one another's banks and railroads and industries and things like that, so that this small group sort of rose in prominence side by side.
Mm-hmm. Isaias had a safe in his store. It was very important because a lot of business, as you say, was done in gold, silver. And that was really sort of the genesis of his bank, the fact that he had a safe.
That's right. Isaias Hellman opened his own dry goods store in 1865. And as a courtesy to his customers, he agreed to keep their valuables in the safe. It was a black Tilden and McFarlane safe, and he put it in the back of his store. And he was content with that arrangement until one day this Irishman came in and deposited a pouch that was stuffed with gold. And then this Irishman proceeded to go out into town and get gloriously drunk and return to Hellman's store, ask for some of his money, go out again, get drunk, even more drunk, return and get money. And he did this over a period of a week. And when he finally sobered up, he came back and asked for his pouch. And when Hellman gave it to him, the pouch was almost empty. And the Irishman got furious, and he lunged at Isaias Hellman, and he accused him of stealing his money. And Hellman was fortunate in that this Irishman had a friend with him who reminded the man that, no, he had in fact taken out all the money while he was drunk. That altercation made Isaias Hellman realize he had to stop this informal banking system that he had set up. And he decided to formally open a bank. And so in that respect, he became the first official banker of Los Angeles.
Mm, amazing. And built on the principle of trust and also of personal knowledge of his clients, which are kind of the bedrock of the banking system. I was in banking for a few years. I was a trust officer, and was impressed with those two principles, which have kind of been set aside since then. I mean, banking has gone wild since I was involved in banking.
he definitely knew his customers, and he definitely, lent to people that he had faith in.
Mm-hmm. His brother Herman followed many of the patterns that Isaiah set. He went into banking himself, but he was never successful as Isaiah's, and eventually there was bad blood between the brothers.
Yes, Isaias and Herman, his younger brother, were just 11 months apart. And so they were very close in many ways, but they were also rivals in many ways. And this is a relationship that extended throughout their entire lives. And the two brothers came to Los Angeles together. Herman eventually opened his own wholesale dry goods store, which did business throughout the Southwest. And he was very successful in that store. He made money. But in 1890, Isaias Hellman moved to San Francisco to take over the Nevada Bank, and he asked his brother Herman to serve as the head of the bank in Los Angeles, which was called the Farmers and Merchants Bank. And it probably seemed like a good idea at the time, two brothers working together. But Isaias Hellman had a hard time giving up control of the bank in Los Angeles. And in Towers of Gold, this is one of the relationships that I tried to explore as fully as possible, this tension between the two brothers. And it continued between them for a long period of time until it finally erupted.
Oh, yeah. I thought you did that contrast between them very well, showing that they always loved each other, even when they were having such a difficult time getting along with each other. Very skillfully done, I think. Not easy to portray a relationship like that. Isaias began to buy land, a very smart thing at that time, and to develop the land. When he was 21 years old, he bought his own land, a lot at the corner of 7th and Hope, for $200, and held on to that land through his entire life.
Yeah, isn't that interesting that he had this sort of nostalgic feeling towards the first parcel of land he bought? Yes, he went on to become one of the largest landowners in Southern California. He bought a part of Rancho Los Alamitos, which is near Long Beach. It was a 26,000-acre rancho. He bought part of Rancho San Pedro. He bought part of Rancho La Cucamonga in San Bernardino County. Plus, he bought a lot of land in just the city of Los Angeles. And he thought that L.A. was going to grow. And he kept that land. And in fact, after his death, it took 35 years to probate his will because it took that long to dispose of a lot of his land holdings.
And he was very wise in his buying decisions. He was a good judge of the land that would be successful for development, I think.
Yeah, no, I think he was very wise. He was very astute financially. But it's also important to remember that this was a time of enormous opportunity in California. So, he could buy a lot of land for very little money. And it went on to, of course, just increase tremendously in value. But, he was the kind of guy who wasn't a speculator. And in the 1880s, there was a huge land boom in Los Angeles. And people were coming and going and buying and selling land. But Hellman did not want to sell his land then. He wanted to keep it because he thought it would grow in appreciation over time even more.
And his next big event in his life was marriage to your great-great-grandmother, who also came from Bavaria, but was on the other coast in New York. And so Isaias made the trip across the country by train. And I want to read just a paragraph of that train trip that will give people just an idea of what train travel was like in those days. Let me find it. Isaias was going to travel in style. While the trip was bumpy and exhausting, the introduction of the luxurious Silver Palace cars on the western section of the trip did a lot to make the time tolerable. Passengers sat in velvet-colored seats surrounded by dark damask coverings and wood-paneled ceilings. There were pianos to play, and books and newspapers to read, all free to first-class passengers. The views through the broad plate-glass windows were spectacular, and travelers often hoped to glimpse Native American warriors riding their horses, albeit at a distance. The train also pulled its own dining car. Travelers could order anything from porterhouse steak and lamb to oysters and fried eggs. At night, Isaias retired to a bunk in a sleeping car. Those were the days.
Yeah, I love the contrast between the Wild West and the luxury. I mean, even, you know, people who built houses in Los Angeles in those days, you know, they wanted to bring in some of the Victorian elegance that they knew about or dreamed about. So here it could be dusty and muddy outside and the garbage everywhere. And inside these houses, there would be horsehair sofas and curtains and china. It was an interesting contrast.
Mm-hmm. And your great-great-grandmother, Esther Newgrass, was 19 years old when she married Isaias. She sounds like a divine woman.
Yes, I think Esther Newgrass was a divine woman. She was certainly a very intelligent woman and a very patient woman. And she and Isaias Hellman had an arranged marriage, but they came to love each other quite a lot. And I think she was very good for him and personally.
Yes, she pepped him up. She was vivacious and lively, and she loved beautiful clothes. He was kind of a sober sides, I think.
Yes, I think that's true.
They must have been a great pair.
One of the most important relationships in Isaias Hellman's life was Esther, his wife, but not just because of the love he had for her, but because Esther's sister Babette was married to Meyer Lehman, who was one of the founder of Lehman Brothers. And by marrying Esther, Hellman's developed a relationship with a man who had access to Eastern capital. And so when he opened his banks in San Francisco, from the very beginning, he had a big, you know, backer. In times of trouble, he could rely on sort of Eastern money to help him out. And so that relationship was absolutely critical, both for Hellman and for the development of California.
Yes, at many critical moments, his access to cash made all the difference in his banking transactions, because when there was a run on the bank, there were places he could go to borrow cash short term to shore up the bank so that people would have confidence
right,
in the bank.
Exactly. In 1875, for example, Esther and Isaias were in Germany. They were at one of the spas, you know, taking the waters. And Hellman got word that his bank in Los Angeles had closed. There had been a bank panic. And Isaias was very upset about this. And he rushed back to, you know, California. And when I say he rushed, in those days, it meant it took him 23 days to get from Europe to California, but that was still pretty quick. And along the way, he stopped in New York and he borrowed $20,000 from Lehman Brothers. And so when he returned to California, he used that money to reopen his bank. And it was critical because it once again showed people that, you know, Hellman had money and the bank wasn't going to go under. And in fact, the only other bank in town did go under.
Mm-hmm. So Isaias and Esther then came back across the country on the luxurious train. That was their honeymoon. And your great-great-grandmother was such a good sport about things. I mean, she sounds like the kind of person who would make the best of whatever situation she was in. And, of course, their life improved dramatically over the years so that they lived in ever more elegant houses as he continued to be more and more successful.
You're right. But first, when she came out here, she moved to this town that didn't have a lot of people in it, mm-hmm. number one, and was pretty crude and violent, and mm-hmm. dust was everywhere. And in the winter, the dust turned to mud. But she was a good sport. Mm-hmm. She loved the outdoors, and she loved to ride horses, and she made a very nice life for herself.
Mm-hmm.
But when the opportunity came, and when he grew wealthier, she also loved to indulge. She loved beautiful dresses and jewelry and decorating her house. So mm-hmm. she sort of lived the whole spectrum of life.
A lovely woman. Mm-hmm. Yeah. You're listening to A Novel Idea. This is Rosemary Manchester, your host. My guest is Frances Dinkelspiel, the author of the biography of her great-great-grandfather, Isaias Hellman. The book is called Towers of Gold. We're going to take just a moment now, and we'll be right back.
They used to tell me I was building a dream, and so I followed the mob. When there was earth to plow or guns to bear, I was always there, right there on the job. They used to tell me I was building a dream, with peace and glory ahead. Why should I be standing in line, just waiting for bread? Once I built a railroad, made it run, made it race against time. Once I built a railroad, now it's done. Brother, can you spare a dime? Once I built a tower to the sun, brick and rivet and lime. Once I built a tower, now it's done. Brother, can you spare a dime? Want some khaki suits? Gee, we look swell.
All right, we're back. This is Rosemary Manchester, your host for A Novel Idea. My guest is Frances Dinkelspiel, the author of the book Towers of Gold, the biography of her great-great-grandfather, Isaias Hellman, one of the founders of California who has somehow dropped through the cracks of history, and Frances has brought his story back to life. And it's a wonderful story and a great book. I remember reading in the book that for quite a while, Isaias Hellman controlled the wine industry in the state of California. How did that come about?
Well, Isaias Hellman had actually been interested in making wine for a long time because in 1870 he acquired part of the Rancho Cucamonga, which had one of the oldest vineyards in California. And in the early part of the American control of California, Southern California was the center of winemaking in the state. And so Hellman bottled wine, sweet wine and port. And in fact, I actually have a bottle from 1875 of his port. So he continued to do that. And then in 1901, he acquired a controlling interest in something called the California Wine Association, which was a company that had bought up more than 50 vineyards around the state, including Greystone Cellars and Stag's Leap and Cucamonga. And they bought all these grapes and they blended wine into a wine that wasn't particularly good, but it was a stable wine, which they then exported all over the United States. So for more than 20 years, Hellman was the head of this conglomerate that dominated the wine industry.
Did they drink wine themselves?
You know, I don't think Hellman did drink wine. But I know his son Marco loved to drink wine.
Well, Isaias seems a man of great rectitude who would certainly never drink too much wine, but I wondered if he had a celebratory glass now and then.
Well, I do think he occasionally had one, and there's a funny story. As he was fleeing the flames of the 1906 earthquake, he handed a box to his daughter-in-law and said, "Be very careful with this box." And she took it, and she thought it was containing cash or jewels. And when they reached this safe haven, she handed it back to him. And he opened it up, and lo and behold, it was a box of cigars. He felt that it was important to rescue them.
By all means, save the cigars. That's a wonderful story. All right, the next big event is the birth of their first child, Isaias Jr., called Marco. What an interesting nickname.
Yeah, I know. It sounds Italian, doesn't it?
Yes.
Well, there were some Hellmans in Italy, and I'm not sure if that's the reason he was called Marco. But there is one thing about the Hellman family is that they tend to name their children and grandchildren with the same name. So we have Marco throughout the generations, Francis throughout the generations, my first name, Florence, Isaias. And it's very funny. And of course, when you're trying to do historical research, it drives you mad because it's hard to figure out who is who.
Yes. When people are writing on the back of photographs, they need to explain which Francis and Florence it is and put a date if possible. Otherwise, it's pretty hard for the people who are doing research. In the process of putting the book together, do you have any personal reflections on the material that you came across and the way in which you were putting it together?
Researching and writing this book was really an amazing experience for me. I mean, I'd grown up knowing a little bit about my family history, but I think like most Americans, I didn't know any details about my family history. And it was just extraordinary to go back and read the words of my ancestors and to be able to piece together, you know, how they led their lives and the decisions they made in their lives. And it really strengthened this connection that I had that I guess I had never been aware of. I am a fifth-generation Californian, and I've always felt rooted in this state. But finding out more about the lives of the people who came before me really made me appreciate where we live and really made me feel very, very close to the people who made my life possible.
Yeah. Of course, you can't talk about the history of California without talking about railroads. That trip by boat from San Francisco to Los Angeles was so tedious. And when the railroad was finally completed so that they could take the train from San Francisco to Los Angeles, it made all the difference in the development of Los Angeles. And you paint a wonderful scene of the joining of the Southern Pacific Railroad in Soledad Canyon with Leland Stanford and Charles Crocker there. It's a little bit like the Golden Spike event in Utah, but exclusively a California milestone.
Yeah, you're right. It was a very big event. And, you know, Los Angeles was worried that the railroad was going to bypass it because the builders wanted to go down straight through the Central Valley. That was going to be easier. And in order to get to Los Angeles, they had to dig a tunnel through the mountains. And this was a very difficult engineering feat. And in fact, they did it, and it became the longest tunnel sort of west of the Mississippi. And when finally the two parts of the railroad were joined, people in Southern California got on a train. They rode up north. They rode through this very long tunnel, and they came to this canyon where they were met by people who had come down from San Francisco. And it had been, of course, the Chinese who had really built the railroads, and they were all waiting for the two trains to pull together. And there were about 3,000 Chinese laborers there. And as soon as the dignitaries arrived, these laborers went to work, and they put in the final, you know, railroad ties, and then the dignitaries drove a final spike, just like they did for the Golden Spike. And it was a very dramatic moment and a very important moment for the development of California, because it really enabled there to be, you know, exchange of people and trading of goods and import and export of things throughout the state.
And then the railroad behaved badly, as the railroads often do. They took advantage of their monopoly on the transportation and raised the freight rates. It made life very uncomfortable for Isaias and the other merchants. And the merchants tried to fight back, but Charles Crocker in the Southern Pacific won.
Absolutely. Well, this is the story of the railroad in California.
Yes.
This is why people were always so nervous about it. Once Southern Pacific had this link from San Francisco to Los Angeles, they also controlled something called the Pacific Mail Steamer, which also took goods up and down the coast. They developed a virtual monopoly on the trade of goods, and they raised prices. And, you know, of course, people were furious about this. And Herman Hellman, Isaias' brother in particular, tried to, you know, create his own little ship company to undermine this, but it didn't work. And once again, Southern Pacific crushed any opposition. And this was, of course, a pattern that continued for many, many decades.
There, so much happened in the Hellman's life. We're skipping lightly through, just hitting the high spots. And as you read the book for yourself, you'll have the chance to see the depth in which Frances has presented the story, and also the amount of detail which she has been able to include, which makes the story come to life. So I'll just mention that Isaias enters politics and runs for the U.S. Senate, but George Hearst wins that one, and that's described as his Isaias first major defeat. About this time, they moved to San Francisco. Now, that's an interesting move. He bought and resurrected the Nevada Bank, leaving his bank in Los Angeles in Herman's hands, which turned out to be not such a good idea, started another bank, the Union Trust. That move to San Francisco, when he did that, do you think he overreached?
No, I don't think he overreached. You know, Los Angeles in 1890 had about 50,000 residents, and San Francisco had more than 300,000 residents, and it had most of the banks and most of the capital in the state. And I think Hellman had risen to the top in Los Angeles, and he wanted to do more. And so he made a bid for the Nevada Bank. And I think proof that he wasn't overreaching was that when he put stock up for sale in his new bank, lines of millionaires clamored to buy the stock. And he only had $2.5 million worth of stock to sell, but he got $15 million worth of applications. And these were from some of the most prominent businessmen around the country. Mm-hmm. So clearly, Hellman was very well respected and regarded at that point in his life. And that was not even the height of his powers. But no, I don't think he overreached. Mm-hmm. In fact, I think he, in a very different way, he actually grew tremendously in San Francisco.
And they built a beautiful summer home up at Lake Tahoe, which people can still visit. Am I right?
That's right. It's called Sugar Pine Point State Park. And this was something I didn't know. I grew up going to Tahoe, and forever it's been a pleasure spot, a tourist resort. But it turns out that people weren't interested in vacationing in Lake Tahoe until around the turn of the century. For many, many years, it was just used as a way station on the way to the silver mines of Nevada. They cut down all the trees to build the silver mines. They sort of didn't look at Lake Tahoe as a place to summer. And Isaias Hellman actually was the first millionaire to build a really large mansion on the lake. And he started accumulating land in 1897. And by 1903, he had built this beautiful, luxurious, yet sort of simple house on the lake. And it still exists today.
And one can visit it.
That's right. One can visit it. And every summer they have something called Living History Day. It's the last Saturday in July. And people dress up like the Hellmans and, you know, they open the door and there are butlers to greet you. And it's a lot of fun.
Do you go up for that?
I do. I've gone up for the last couple of years and given a talk about Isaias Hellman.
Oh, wonderful. And tell us again when it is.
It's usually the last Saturday in July. And it's on the west shore of Lake Tahoe.
Uh-huh. All right. There's a very sad part of the story that your chapter on that is called Betrayal. Would you tell us that sad story?
Yes, this is a very sad story. It was also one of the most challenging stories to uncover doing this book. Isaias Hellman had a cousin named Henry Fleischman, whom he loved greatly. He admired Fleischman, and he brought him to live with him, his family, when Fleischman was a teenager, and he put him to work in his bank. And Fleischman was very athletic and very charismatic and handsome, but he was not a particularly responsible person. He was more interested in playing and women and that kind of thing. But Hellman always sort of ignored his faults because he was so fond of him. And in 1901... Hellman was chagrined to discover that Henry Fleischman had embezzled about $300,000 from his bank and fled to South America with the money. And this was just heartbreaking to Hellman because he thought he'd given Fleischman everything, only to find that this man secretly resented him.
And it was a stain on the family name, which I think was so hard for Isaias to come to terms with.
It was a very big stain. And in fact, Hellman, you know, he held a press conference. He told everyone about the relationship. He, put up a reward for Fleischman's return. But he was never completely frank about the amount of money Fleischman had stolen. He was never completely open about what exactly had gone on between them because it was so humiliating to him.
There's kind of a rhythm in the book of good things, bad things. And when the bad things come, you just feel so bad that something like that could happen to a man of such character and integrity as your great-great-grandfather.
Well, you know, of course, there are always two sides to every story. And I think Isaias Hellman was a man of great character and integrity who worked hard for himself and for others. But, you know, I think other people may have regarded him as arrogant and powerful and said it looked at him in a way different than his, you know, family or friends looked at him.
And there was a certain inflexibility in your great-great-grandfather, which is, I think, characteristic of many men of that time and of who had had such tremendous success doing it one particular way.
Yeah, I think you're right. I mean, I, of course, never got to meet him or talk to him, but I sensed that certainly as he grew older and more successful, you know, he had done so many things right in his life that he just assumed that his judgment was very sound. And so sometimes he projected that certainty on others, and maybe he didn't listen to mm-hmm. what they had to say, or he didn't consider their points of view as carefully as he might have.
Mm-hmm. And of course, by this time, the Hellmans had a beautiful home in San Francisco, which was even nicer than the one that they'd had in Los Angeles. And you did a wonderful thing at this point in the book. You sneaked up on me, and I was so impressed when I realized what had happened. I was reading along, you know, in the narrative, and this happened and that. Their wonderful house in San Francisco, their great life, all the things they were doing. One night they went to the opera. It didn't even occur to me that this is 1906, and all of a sudden, the earthquake. I mean, I was as surprised by that earthquake as I think that the people who were there must have been surprised. But because of the skill in your writing, you didn't foreshadow that at all. You just presented it as the cataclysm that it was. They went to the opera, they went home, they went to bed, and at 5 o'clock the next morning there was this terrible earthquake.
Oh, well, that's good to hear. I'm glad that I surprised you because, you know, it's such a major event in California history.
Of course.
But I sort of wanted to tell it in a different way.
Yes.
Through the eyes of a banker. You know, what happens when a city burns, when every bank burns, when no one has any money, and there's, you know, what's going to happen to the future? And this is the role that Isaias Hellman played after the earthquake. You know, he and his family, they survived the earthquake just fine. Hellman went down to his bank on Pine and Montgomery Street that morning. They opened the bank as usual when all of a sudden the fire department came in and said, get out, get out, get out. And they left. And of course, then the fire raged for 3 days. Hellman and his family went across the bay to his son's country house, another Hellman home that you can still visit. It's called the Dunsmuir Hellman Historic Estate. And when Hellman returned to San Francisco, the thing that worried him the most wasn't the utter destruction of the city, but he was afraid of another bank run, another bank panic, because he knew that San Francisco could rebuild. But if everybody went and took all their money out of the banks and were so worried that they wouldn't trust the institutions, he felt that it would be much harder to bring capital from the East Coast that would be needed in order to rebuild the city. So he worked with other bankers to coordinate the reopening of all the banks to get people the money that they needed.
But that wonderful dramatic scene about opening the vault, they had to wait for the vault to cool off. And then would the contents of the vault have survived that terrible fire?
That's right. He had to wait 3 weeks to find out if the money and all the bank records had survived the fire, because if they opened the vault too early, oxygen would have been sucked into the superheated interior and it would have exploded all the contents. Mm-hmm. So I think that was an agonizing time, you know, for them waiting to know whether or not the vaults survived.
Well, you presented that beautifully. I was on the edge of my seat.
Oh, great.
Will the vault be all right? Yes. Yes. How would you characterize the legacy of your great-great-grandfather, Isaias Hellman?
I think the most significant legacy of Isaias Hellman is Wells Fargo Bank. You know, he bought it in 1905. It was just a small institution, and it is today one of the strongest banks in the country. And in fact, it weathered this recent economic crisis so well that it was able to acquire Wachovia. And I do believe many of Isaias's business attitudes do continue in Wells Fargo Bank today. So I think that's very important. He also was a regent of the University of Southern California and donated land to found the University of Southern California. So I believe that, you know, he has left a gift to the educational system of California.
But it's a wonderful thing when someone who hasn't been particularly blessed with the opportunity to study makes it so important in his life to provide that opportunity for others.
Yeah, I think you're correct. He was, you know, not that well educated. He went to primary school. He did go to secondary school for 2 years. But he always valued learning, and he pushed his children to learn. His son went to the University of California in the early years, and he really felt it was important in order to grow a state, in order to foster business and community, that people needed to be well-educated. And so he was generous financially also to various to educational institutions. He made sure to donate money that they could flourish.
And, of course, your great-great-grandmother contributed so much to the charitable activities of both San Francisco and Los Angeles. She was so active in reaching out to other people, particularly helping those who were poor. And kindergartens was one of her great passions.
Yeah, Esther Hellman really personifies the transformation of the American woman from someone who, or I should say wealthy American woman, from someone who is more concerned with clothes and visiting hours and luncheons, to someone who works in the community. She was very involved in developing kindergartens both in Southern California and in Northern California. She was on the board of the Ladies Auxiliary of Mount Zion Hospital, and she did many things. And in fact, after her early death, Isaias Hellman donated $100,000 to Mount Zion Hospital so that they could build a new building. And that building still stands on Divisadero and Sutter Street in San Francisco, and there's still a plaque that says this building was erected in the loving memory of Esther Hellman.
At the end, you do something really nice for the reader. You have an epilogue in which you tie up all the loose ends, and some of the you trace your own family history. And you talked about F. Warren Hellman. Is he your brother or your cousin?
Warren Hellman is my cousin.
Your cousin, mm-hmm. And the banjo player.
The banjo player. You know,
yes.
I don't have a family tree in my book, but on my website, towersofgold.com,
oh, good.
There's a family tree.
So it's on the website.
Right. So I know
Excellent.
A lot of people have wanted to know who's related to whom and
right.
what happened.
Well, so that, all right, that's always easier if you see a chart. And something so interesting about your cousin Warren, he's the founder of the Hardly Strictly Bluegrass Festival, which is extremely popular, of course, with people up here. I have many friends who go to the Hardly Strictly.
If you've never been, I highly recommend that you go. It's a
I
fantastic
really want to go.
Concert. Yeah, Warren Hellman, Isaias Hellman's great-grandson, must have inherited some financial gene from his great-grandfather, because he is one of the most successful businessmen in America today. His company, Hellman Friedman, has invested in many important companies. But Warren's true love is playing the banjo. And here he was, a very wealthy man, and he could, you know, meet anyone or do anything. And he decided what he really wanted to do was meet musicians. So he started this small festival where he invited women like Hazel Dickens and others to come. And it's now expanded into this 3-day extravaganza of 80 bands spread across 5 stages. And it's absolutely free. Warren pays for everything because he loves music so much and he loves San Francisco so much.
I know people who plan their calendar around that, so because it's the big annual event. The last paragraph in the book is about Warren. Warren's success begs the question of whether genius for finance can be passed on through genes. Despite Warren's achievements, he thinks of his ancestor, Isaias Hellman, every day and feels he comes up short in comparison. What a lovely ending.
Well, thank you.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, I think I was definitely born lucky. I do have a lovely family, and you know, I've gotten to know many more of them through the writing of this book, people who I knew about but I had not seen growing up. And you know, it that has been so much fun. Mm-hmm. So I feel mm-hmm. lucky.
Frances Dinkelspiel, thank you so much for writing this book and taking the time to come and talk with us about it. And your great-great-grandfather, Isaias Hellman, and your great-great-grandmother, Esther. You have really restored Isaias to his rightful place in the pantheon of great men of California, and we owe you a tremendous debt for that. The book is Towers of Gold, How One Jewish Immigrant Named Isaias Hellman Created California. The book was published in 2008 by St. Martin's Press and is available at your independent bookstore. If you love California, if you love history, if you love a good story and fine writing, this one's for you. Special thanks to Suzanne Lang, who produces the show, and to Robin Pressman, program director at KRCB, who put this book in my hand and said, "I think you'll like this one." This is Rosemary Manchester, your host for A Novel Idea, reminding you that there's no such thing as too many books.